from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, the Arab television channel Al Jazeera aired a chilling audio tape reportedly from Osama bin Laden. In the four-minute communique, the al-Qaeda leader praised global terror attacks in Moscow and Bali. He threatened retaliation over Iraq, quote, "You will be killed just as you kill," said the voice, "and will be bombed just as you bomb." In this hour, bin Laden alive and America's rocky response to terror. We begin with the latest on the purported bin Laden tape, which U.S. officials said today appears to be authentic and recently recorded. Magnus Ronstorp is deputy director of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University in Scotland. I asked him to interpret the timing of the release of the message from Osama bin Laden.
There's a lot of things going on right now which really shows that we are living in a very dangerous world. There is a clear and present danger from al-Qaeda. Beyond that, the timing of the statement by bin Laden, I believe, is no accident. I'm sure it's time to coincide with the imminent war, the U.S. and coalition war against Iraq. But of course, you know, we have to look at this in context. In Europe, there's been a frenetic anxiety from Germany, France, and the United Kingdom about a heightened state of alert, particularly with regards to generic threats against ferries, maritime targets. Even the Secretary General of the Interpol came out with a statement saying basically that there is the expectation among the intelligence community that al-Qaeda is preparing, planning, and possibly trying to execute simultaneous multi-pronged attacks against a number of different countries. This statement comes in tandem with this type of a heightened noise level in the intelligence community. There's also been the recognition that there is a heightened noise level, in other words, intercepts by the signals intelligence community on par with what we saw during September the 11th. And this, of course, makes everyone exceptionally nervous that something is in the air. Bin Laden, in particular, used to issue statements or warnings about an impending attack. And then we've seen the 1998 East Africa bombing and the USS Cole. So everyone is very nervous about this.
Let me ask you this. All the talk in the United States in the last few weeks has been about Iraq and potential war with Iraq. If we now see that bin Laden is in fact alive, and if al-Qaeda is operational, as it appears to be, rather richly operational, we're told, how do you imagine that this terrorist organization would like to see its activity intersect with a war on Iraq?
We're moving towards a confluence of two separate issues. I mean, we have the issue of Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, and we have the attempts by the U.S. administration to tie Iraq with al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And I think that there may be an accidental convergence of interest. I mean, what we will see in a war with Iraq is a massive outpour of radicalization and mobilization in the street, in the Arab street. And that may produce two things. It may produce not only pre-planned operations by al-Qaeda and also perhaps spontaneous attacks, but it may push the two sides closer together.
What is the likelihood that a war on Iraq will be brought home to Europe and the United States?
It depends very much on what direction. You know, there's all sorts of direction this conflict may spiral towards. It may involve a complete meltdown. It may go very well. I think at best what we'll see is a lot of protest, and we will see a lot of spontaneous action. But I'm sure that given the fact that the holiday season is coming up as well, coalescing, you know, Christmas, it makes it especially worrisome when it comes to the possibility that al-Qaeda particularly will seize on the opportunity. But I cannot see the fact that the Iraqi intelligence service will control any al-Qaeda operations, but it's more of a confluence of interest against a common enemy.
It wasn't so long ago that American officials were saying with some kind of muted confidence that they believed that Osama bin Laden was quite likely dead. Now they're saying it appears he's quite likely alive. Why has it been so difficult for American forces to track down, capture, or kill Osama bin Laden?
it's exceptionally difficult to track down him. I'm sure he will be lying low. You know, we have to understand that we're dealing with Al-Qaeda, which is an organization, which is a hierarchical organization, as well as an umbrella group. And this organization, or whether you call it a loosely organized network, they know the capabilities of the intelligence community. They know that they can track them, you know, when they're using mobile phones. They know how to circumvent tracking efforts of using email and so forth. They know command-control communication, and they've perfected that to a fine art. And therefore, it's very difficult for the United States to pinpoint exactly the whereabouts of particular individuals.
But it's now been a year since U.S. forces went into Afghanistan in force. There have been repeated sweeps along the Afghan-Pakistan border. In all that time, one might have thought that they could have been in practically every town and village along that frontier.
Well, you know, in today's environment, you can easily hide in a basement, you can easily hide underground, you can stay put, you can use couriers who have acceptable travel paths, and they can move, you know, quickly, you know, passing messages, passing this type of tape that's been recently released. So it's like worse than finding a needle in a haystack. And unless he uses some electronic means, unless we have someone on the inside, unless we know, even if there are rumors where he is, I'm sure that those leads have been followed up on. Even by Pentagon's own admission, it's going to take at least until the year 2008, 2009, until we make a realistic dent in Al-Qaeda.
So at this point, Osama bin Laden appears to be alive. He may be hiding, as you say, underground in a basement, who knows where, from that hideout. How dangerous is Osama bin Laden? How vulnerable is the United States and Europe?
The United States is not more vulnerable because bin Laden pops up, but I think you know, he puts us on alert. It really shows that, look, you know, from all your capability, you can't even find me. But more importantly, he's trying to mobilize a wider constituency against the Iraqi war, against other issues in the region. And I think it's going to be very difficult to be able to find him, and he's not that important for the organization. Of course, it's an embarrassment that we haven't found him, but what we really have to find is people that are the operational masterminds, who are the ones that activate, who are the ignition key for the more larger complex operations. While at the same time, we have to work with our allies, we have to work multilaterally, we have to work all across the world in forging closer intelligence relationships and in trying to find the foot soldiers that are the ones that are trying to carry out what bin Laden is publicly trying to advocate.
Magnus Ronstorp, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Magnus Ronstorp is Deputy Director at the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University in Scotland. He spoke with me earlier today from St. Andrews. American officials had said, or maybe hoped, that Osama bin Laden was dead. The tape released yesterday, which you can hear behind me, suggests that hope was premature. That bin Laden is not gone, but alive and planning more terror for the United States and its allies. Must America be vulnerable to an angry man in an Afghan basement? The word from Washington is that we are and have been for years. That America's security apparatus did not brace for terror and is still not up to the challenge. Can we expect more from the FBI and the CIA, from the coming Department of Homeland Security? Where is our defense against terror? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Washington is Daniel Benjamin. He's co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. He served on the National Security Council staff in the Clinton administration from 1994 to 1999. Good evening and welcome to On Point, Daniel Benjamin.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us in the studio tonight is On Point's news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Benjamin.
Daniel Benjamin, you've laid out a lot in your new book, The Age of Sacred Terror, and we're going to dig into that. But bring us right up to date first, if you would. The emergence of this new tape from Osama bin Laden indicating that he is indeed alive and that the tape was made recently enough that he's referring to terrorist events all over the world. All of this has brought the terror threat back front and center of the national mind. What is your sense as you look out over the boardwalk here today of how prepared the United States security apparatus is to deal with the kind of terror threats that we face?
There's been one absolutely critical improvement in American preparedness since 9/11, and that is quite simply awareness. One of the themes that we develop at great length in our book is about how there was an old paradigm of thinking about terrorism that suggested that it was always going to be with us and it was always going to be a marginal phenomenon, and that would only cause a limited number of casualties.
A hijacking here, a hijacking there, but we can live with it.
Yes, a hijacking here, a hijacking there, and also a desire by terrorists to keep the casualties to a certain calibrated and often minimal level, because if they did real catastrophic damage, then they would effectively rule themselves out as a future negotiating partner. And most of these groups are about some kind of incremental change. When we get religiously motivated terror appearing in the 90s, all that changes. And suddenly we have groups that want to really kill on the grand scale. Very few people in the bureaucracy in the mid to late 90s really believed that. There was a pocket in the White House that believed it, and it included the National Security Advisor and the president. There was a good number of people at CIA who believed it, and there were individuals scattered throughout what we call the interagency. But by and large, it was very, very difficult to convince people without the evidence of an event like 9/11.
And now we've had 9/11. We've had that, and we're going to look back at the root of this that goes back into the Clinton administration. But we hear, even this week, Senator Bob Graham, who was on our show recently, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, saying our security apparatus, they still don't know where the terrorists are, how many are here, what their intentions are, what kind of support network they have. He said he's frustrated with the FBI in spite of all his briefings. He says they can't give me an answer because they don't have one. They have so little to show for their work, and we have so little time to take action now. Is this political grandstanding, or is this a reasonable assessment of an unprepared security apparatus?
Well, Senator Graham is one of the last people in Washington who goes in for political grandstanding. I think it's probably the comment of a fairly exasperated man, but it's not far off from the truth. The FBI has years of catching up to do, and no amount of acceleration, no amount of concentration is going to make that go more quickly, because they simply, didn't have the leads for all those years as to where these radical Islamists were.
So are you saying no amount of investigation or no amount of structural change within the agency?
Well, some amount of structural change is needed. Some of that amount has been done. One of the ironies, unfortunately, is that in the post 9/11 months, several of the people who really had the best idea about terrorism have left. This has been, I think, part of the natural progress of careers, and partly also that Director Mueller wants his own people in there. There are very few people at the FBI who have any experience with counterterrorism, and there were certainly very, very few who were, metaphorically speaking, inside the head of the terrorists.
Jack Beatty, Robert Mueller, FBI director, saying on October 17th, I would be uncomfortable in saying that you should relax and say the FBI or the CIA is taking care of that issue, talking about terrorism.
Yes, and I think one reason is that some of the same personnel are there, some of the men who made these mistakes, and there has not been a house cleaning. And our listeners should know that the Homeland Security bill, to which the Democrats have now agreed, has dropped a provision that was in the original bill, according to the Los Angeles Times, that would have established an independent commission to finally get to the bottom of all the mistakes that were made, to ask the tough questions, and to hold people accountable and responsible. We're not now going to have that, apparently.
We did that for Pearl Harbor. We're not going to do it for 9/11?
It appears not.
A lot to talk about here. Daniel Benjamin, stand by. We're going to dive into this from 16 different angles. Daniel Benjamin's new book is The Age of Sacred Terror. We're talking tonight about America's rocky war on terror in the 90s and even now. Why is the USA so confident in conventional war and so nervous in the war on terror? Do we have what it takes culturally and institutionally to fight this kind of invisible foe? Is potential war with Iraq taking our eye off the real threat? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's rocky war on terror. My guest is Daniel Benjamin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He served on the National Security Council staff in the Clinton administration from 1994 to 1999, and he's co-author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. The FBI says it may take 10 years to reform, to catch up. Do we have that kind of time? Are we still sleepwalking in a terror minefield? You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel Benjamin, take us back to the 90s when you were closely watching the security situation in the United States on the National Security Council. You had a front row seat with the Clinton administration. Of course, there was a lot of terror going on there. Fill in some of that picture. It's kind of fallen into history very quickly here. Remind us of the terror blows that were being landed even then and how the government of the United States was able and unable to respond.
Well, we date the beginning of the new terror, the religiously motivated terror, actually to the killing of Meir Kahane, the radical rabbi who founded the Jewish Defense League in America and then emigrated to Israel. Where he was a political leader, he was killed in New York by a man named El-Sayed Nozer, and this was the first place where we stumbled because the assumption was that the person who did it was deranged, and there was no wider connection.
Remind
and
us the year of that killing.
I'm sorry.
The year of that killing was
1990.
Right,
And. So that one really went under the radar. Mm-hmm. In 1993, Ramzi Youssef engineered the first bombing of the World Trade Center. And once again, I think we underestimated the extent of the conspiracy, in part because outside of Ramzi himself, the conspirators were a pretty unimpressive lot. One of them kept trying to get the deposit back on the
Ryder truck. You write that he looked like a fool to the American authorities.
Exactly. And I think that the FBI in particular thought that any group that needed to rely on someone like Mr. Salome, the person who returned the to the Ryder agency to get his deposit, couldn't be taken seriously.
But still, things got serious. It wasn't an attack on the World Trade Center. We did see the Khobar Towers attack, where plenty of Americans died. We saw the attack on the USS Cole.
And all of that, well, the USS Cole, of course, was not till 1999, by which point, within the government at least, I think the realization has dawned that we're up against something new and much, much greater. During the mid-90s, we saw an enormous growth in the amount of money that was going into counterterrorism in the organization of the federal government. There was a lot of sort of relocation of authority into the White House. And there was just a much more serious attitude. It had been literally a third-tier concern for the intelligence community before. It was now a first-tier concern.
Who was pushing it up the line, and who grabbed onto it? What attitude did Bill Clinton take toward these threats?
The primary driver in this was the White House, which immediately recognized, particularly after the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City, And also the TWA 800, which was originally thought of as a terrorist attack, but then turned out not to be. It was immediately clear that terrorism was a presidential issue, that it had national implications that would really go to the very political viability of an administration. And so it had to be taken very seriously, and control had to be brought into the White House. And there were a number of presidential decision directives that did that. It sounds tedious and bureaucratic, but it's actually extremely important.
But you make the case that even when this became a top priority, or at least a high-level priority of the White House, that did not guarantee action. In fact, you make the case that the president's power to act on that kind of insight and fear and threat is much more limited than most Americans would understand. Give us some sense of moments in time when the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton himself, wanted action in response to terrorism and was not able to get it from the bureaucracies beneath him.
Well, the most telling moments were when The president personally asked for military options so that we could go into Afghanistan and apprehend or, if necessary, kill bin Laden and the senior leadership of al-Qaeda. These requests were made twice. The first time, I believe, in 1999 or maybe very late 1998. Mm-hmm. And the answer that came back was, well, we can do it. We will do it, of course. But to do it, we need several divisions, billions of dollars. We essentially need to occupy all of Afghanistan. This, of course, was not tenable. It was not politically credible. The president was having a hard time sustaining any backing for the operation in Kosovo, where there was clearly genocidal acts going on. So that was not in the works.
You write that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Hugh Shelton, in your view, actually put forward that long grocery list of requirements for going in with boots on the ground is kind of a deliberate ploy to keep it from happening. It was more that he knew than the president would sanction.
I think the Pentagon leadership understood that. Of course, there was a second go-round when the White House said specifically, we want what's called a small package. We want to have special forces go in and locate the al-Qaeda leadership and take it out. And the answer that came back then was, can't be done. It'll be Desert One. And you sure don't want to lose a whole bunch of American soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan.
Desert One, Jimmy Carter's failed effort to go in after the hostages in Tehran.
Exactly, in 1980.
Years ago. So where's the failing here? Is this a failing on the part of American security apparatus, or is it a failure of leadership on the part of the commander-in-chief?
Well, people will have different views on that. My own feeling is that absent basis for convincing the American people that there was an urgent national security threat. We in the White House had a very hard time forcing the Pentagon to do this. The Pentagon, has a way of leaking these things and making it look as though the political leadership is ready to waste, as one of our interviewees said, a former undersecretary of state, said, waste American boys' blood on a wild goose chase. And in retrospect, this may seem hard to accept, but the reality was at the time that without, the support of your senior military leaders, it's very hard to carry out a military operation.
Jack Beatty, here is the footfall of approaching terror that Daniel Benjamin describes. And it was clear, and he says the White House heard it loud and clear, and yet the country and its security agencies, even the military, were unable or unwilling to respond. Has 9/11 changed all that? Has the election of George Bush changed that somehow?
Well, I don't think the election of George Bush changed it, and I think Mr. Benjamin's book goes into this, that when the new administration came in, their attitude, at least reading between the lines of his book, I had a look at it rapidly, it seemed to be a kind of churlish rejection of all things Clinton. For example, the Clinton administration Defense Department had prepared a disinformation campaign that was supposed to strike at the Taliban and create distance between the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Rumsfeld nixed it. Vice President Cheney was given the anti-terrorism portfolio. He never had a meeting, so far as I know. Condoleezza Rice, in the famous briefing with the president in August of just before September 11th, said, we didn't know. We didn't think that they could use planes as missiles when it was on the record that there had been talk of this, that there'd been an imbroglio in the Philippines involving that, that there'd been something in Paris. In short, the Bush administration had other fish to fry as well. And so the election of George Bush, I don't think, changed it at all. In fact, it may have pushed this further down the road.
Daniel Benjamin, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome onto the show Robert Blitzer. He's joining us tonight from Centerville, Virginia. He was chief of domestic terrorism at the FBI from 1996 to 98. He's now associate director of the Center for Counterterrorism Technology and Analysis of Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC. Good evening and welcome, Robert Blitzer.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Robert Blitzer, you have seen Daniel Benjamin in his book, The Age of Sacred Terror, take some pretty tough shots at the FBI for how it was responding and not responding to a terror threat in the 1990s. You were intimately involved in that time. Is it your sense that we were somehow institutionally or culturally asleep at the switch here?
Well, I don't think we were asleep at the switch, but I can tell you this, that we had a very small staff, particularly in the early 90s up through 95. And part of the problems that I think I saw was the fact that we did not have a robust cadre of people, either at headquarters or in the field during those days, that could get their arms around the length and breadth of this developing problem.
What was the size of the staff put up against the terror threat?
Well, I mean, the size of the staff at headquarters was less than 100.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't get into the exact numbers. The size in the field were less than 1,000 investigators. And, you know, that not only involves international terrorist operations, but also domestic terrorist operations. Because remember, during this time frame, we were not only being beset by the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, but we were also being beset by a spike in domestic terrorist activities, mm-hmm. Vis-a-vis the Mirror City bombing, as well as some militia groups and others that were out there, and we were contending with all of these things simultaneously.
And when you look out now, Robert Blitzer, at the response since 9/11, and you, like us, have heard the comments or read the comments from Robert Mueller, who's still not expressing real brass-jawed confidence here. How confident do you feel that the organizational changes have been made, that the resources have been provided to make the FBI something like effective? How long will it take?
Well, I feel a lot better today than I did a year ago, to be honest with you, or 2 years ago, because I think that there has been a sea change over there, and I think they have moved a lot of resources onto this particular target. But the problems are deep, and what I mean by that is that you just don't take agents who have been working other violations or in other areas of the Bureau and make up expert counterterrorism agents overnight. I mean, when you're looking at an adversary or a foe like this, you have to really understand where he's coming from, what his history is, what the history of Islam is, for example. You have to understand how to deal with people of other faiths and other cultures. And, you know, that doesn't happen overnight. And it's the same way with analytical capability. You don't bring someone into an organization and say, you're an analyst, go to work. I mean, it takes a lot of training. It takes a lot of experience.
We read about a process of years in catching up with the train here. Daniel Benjamin, Robert Blitzer, please stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I want to welcome them in. Andrew's on the line. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
2 points. The first point is that I read in the Wall Street Journal a couple months back that the Clinton administration had no less than 2 opportunities to get bin Laden, you know, from have him actually handed over by the Sudan and by the Taliban.
Okay.
But at the time, in their defense, at the time, both Sudan and the Taliban probably topped the world's list of unpopular, detestable regimes.
Still, it would have been nice if we would have taken bin Laden from them, I guess.
Well, it's 2020 hindsight, and that 9/11 truly represents a clear escalation in, shall we say, terrorism's war on us. It may have been low level for the longest time, and that it was, as one of your guests had pointed out, calculated to be low enough to be an irritant, but not big enough for us to come after them.
So what's your level of confidence now, Andrew?
Well, that's a good question. I think we're probably still in a learning phase, because the second part of my point is that after such an escalation, there is a natural period where we're all playing catch-up. I mean, we played catch-up for the better part of a year after we got into World War II, and we really didn't start to turn around things until maybe late 42 and early 43.
It did take a while. We got your point, of course, as Jack Beatty points out, at least in the Pearl Harbor case, there were investigations and heads rolled. But let's pick these up. And, Andrew, thank you for your call. Daniel Benjamin, what about this, the charge that the Clinton administration had two opportunities to pick up bin Laden and just didn't do it?
This, I'm curious at the attribution as to the Wall Street Journal, because I've seen these allegations elsewhere. I haven't seen them in the journal.
Do you know what Andrew's talking about here?
I'm sorry?
Do you know what Andrew's talking about here, the incidents,
yes,
the moments?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'd like to I'd very much like to address them, because I have looked into this extensively. There was never a moment when the government of Sudan offered the United States custody of bin Laden. And there was never a moment, and I know this for a fact, that when the Taliban, I mean, I know them both for facts, mm-hmm. when the Taliban offered custody of bin Laden to the United States. It is true that the United States in the mid-90s had discussions with the Sudanese about bin Laden. And what transpired was the U.S. did not have an indictment and therefore could not take possession of him anyway. He was never offered to us formally. We said to them, can you send him to Saudi Arabia? And we talked to the Saudis, you know, his country of origin, and the Saudis said, we don't want him. And it was at that point that bin Laden was shown the door and went to Afghanistan. There's simply no credible evidence that the Sudanese ever wanted to give him to us because, well, first, there's no trail. There's no paper. There's no recollection of any major policymaker. But additionally, the Sudanese weren't going to do this because bin Laden would have revealed Sudan's extensive complicity in terrorism. Mm-hmm. And I know of no evidence whatsoever about the Taliban offering bin Laden.
So here's some pushback that there were not necessarily such offers, though perhaps opportunity is a different word. Andrew, thank you for your call. Robert Blitzer, we just have you for another minute, I know. As American citizens, how do you suggest we look at the reforms, the changes going on, and gauge whether or not we're getting a sufficient, an appropriate response from our government, from our security agencies?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think there's been major changes at the FBI, and I think this director, this new director, has clearly seen that our capabilities needed to be pumped up extensively, and he's gone about it, I think, as best he can. I think that, the funding's got to be there, Tom, and this has been something that's been very problematic in the past, getting the adequate funding for resources in this program. And I think Dan mentioned earlier this was a small program in years past, then post particularly post the Murrah City bombing is when, and that wasn't even an Islamic fundamentalist attack, but at that point there was I think the light went on and a heck of a lot of funding started coming in. But again, it's got to continue, and I think over time this will turn around and it will get a lot better, and it probably is a lot better today. I know it is than it was a year ago.
We've got to hope for that. Robert Blitzer, we're out of time before the break here, but thank you for joining us. Robert Blitzer was chief looking over domestic terrorism at the FBI from 1996 to 1998. We're talking about America's rocky war on terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's rocky, it's patchy, war on terror. Our guest tonight is Daniel Benjamin. He's co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror and a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. How much power do presidents really have to push through change in entrenched security bureaucracies? Why have no heads rolled for the 9/11 catastrophe? And can we demand national security in an age of terror? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel Benjamin, I'll put that question to you. Why have no heads rolled for what happened on 9/11? If they rolled after Pearl Harbor, why shouldn't they roll after an attack like that?
If I can deflect that for 1 second, I only wanted to say that I'm sorry I didn't get a chance say something I didn't get a chance to before, which is that, you know, of the many people who were involved with the terrorist problem, Bob Blitzer was certainly one of the heroes, and I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to note that earlier. He was one of the few voices at the FBI who was really pushing for a greater understanding of the groups and a greater evaluation of the intelligence.
Kudos to Mr. Blitzer.
Yes, but why have no heads rolled? Well, no heads have rolled because there were no appropriate heads available to roll.
How can that be?
That's one part of the answer. The Director Mueller came on board just a few weeks before 9/11. It certainly would not have been fair for him to lose his head. Frankly, I think that it would have been an injustice if the director of the CIA had had his head roll, because the CIA, at least on the analytics side, had done a pretty good job of describing the threat and warning of it. You know, there are questions as to whether or not the agents in the field, the director of operations, was as keyed into the threat and as eager to act as we might have liked. But it is certainly true that the agency as a whole was very alert and doing, I think, a very, pretty good job.
Jack Beatty, come in here. Remind us, if you'd be so kind, just as a point of contrast, what happened after Pearl Harbor in terms of investigation and heads rolling?
Well, within days of Pearl Harbor, to my recollection, President Roosevelt asked Chief Justice Roberts of the Supreme Court to go to Hawaii and to have an investigation. And the Roberts report came in, I believe, not 30 or perhaps a month and a half after Pearl Harbor, and it was unsparing. The two commanders, Admiral Kimmel and General Short, were cashiered. Their intelligence people were cashiered. There were some changes in Washington. And that wasn't the end of the matter. They came back to it after the war. In fact, during the war, there was yet another investigation. So
it went right down the line.
They went right down the line, yeah.
Is there not something to be said, Daniel Benjamin, for a kind of cleaning house to get a new perspective in there? Or is your view that would be a loss of insight? You know, is this protecting intelligence, or is this political prevarication?
It's a very good question. I think that there might have been a sort of public benefit to having some sacrifice on the altar of the public good, but it just where would one have started? The person who comes in for the most criticism in our book is a former Director Free, who did not take this threat terribly seriously, and who presided over an FBI that was virtually an independent branch of government, and frankly, he was not within reach. And I have to say, when he came before the Joint Committee of the Congress investigating 9/11, he filibustered, committee let him do so. They ducked any tough questions.
We live in a different time, and it doesn't necessarily make us feel safer. Gail is on the line. Hi, Gail. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
You're very welcome. I often try and call your shows, and this is one of the first times I've gotten through.
Hey, we're glad to have you.
Thank you. Now, I don't have so much of a question as a feeling, but maybe it's both. And my father was an international lawyer.
Okay.
He worked under the Kennedy administration as legal advisor of the State Department. Anyway, that's my credential. But the way I feel is that somehow we are using Iraq kind of as a smokescreen, as a distraction. I think all the money we're spending, sending troops and stuff over there before we even, have anything to do with taking away from what we might be spending on security and, protection.
Gail, you raise a good point, and it's one we want to put to Daniel Benjamin. Thank you for calling it in. Daniel Benjamin, how about it? Does the effort to pincer in on Saddam Hussein, in your view, generally bolster the security situation globally in a way that enhances our protection against terror, or does it provoke terror? Does it diffuse our resources?
There are good reasons for confronting Saddam Hussein, the chief one among them being the possibility that he will acquire a nuclear weapon and try to change the entire geopolitical situation in the Persian Gulf region. Terrorism is not a good reason for going after Saddam Hussein. He has historically had no significant relationship with al-Qaeda, which I believe is the biggest threat that we face. And his intelligence service is in terrible shape and is not capable of carrying out a serious terrorist attack, or at least on most days we could stop anything that they would try.
But we heard Magnus Ronstorp at the top of the hour saying that we may be willy-nilly creating a kind of confluence of interests between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Can we weave them together and kill them both, or are we somehow engendering a bigger giant here?
We need to be clear that a military confrontation with Iraq will have costs, and one of the chief costs is that it will stir up the jihadists. It will stir that nest. We will see a lot of radical Islamists from all over the world really migrate to the Persian Gulf area to try to attack Americans. There is the possibility that in the fog of war, we would not be able to control all of the chemical and biological weapons that Saddam has, and that some of these might be sold by disaffected Iraqis who realize they have no future.
Or even by Saddam Hussein as a kind of parting gift to another foe. Last question. Our time is running down. President Bush has made the passage of the Department of Homeland Security's creation a top priority. How big an advance do you see that as being?
There's certainly some rationalization that's required. Anyone who's worked in the government and security matters knows that it's bewildering. But I think that we've missed the point. I mean, when you don't know what to do, you reorganize. And so much of the political capital has been spent on getting this super bureaucracy that is going to have enormous management problems that I worry that we haven't done some of the key things we need to do to get our law enforcement and intelligence communities, which are really the pointy edge of the spear, into better shape.
Daniel Benjamin, thank you for bringing us in your book, The Age of Sacred Terror, a view of where we've been. We'll keep tabs with you on where we're headed. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
That was my pleasure.
Daniel Benjamin is co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror and senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a translation of the tape believed to have been recorded by Osama bin Laden. This is On Point. Bush administration officials are conceding that the voice on a tape broadcast yesterday on the Arab satellite television network Al Jazeera is most likely that of Osama bin Laden. And because he discusses recent events like the Moscow theater hostage standoff, the tape appears to confirm that the al-Qaeda leader is alive. In his chilling message, bin Laden says, "You will be killed just as you kill and will be bombed just as you bomb." Here are excerpts from that tape along with an English translation.
In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, from the slave of God, Osama bin Laden, to the peoples of the countries allied with the tyrannical U.S. government. The incidents that have taken place since the raids on New York and Washington up until now, like the killings of Germans in Tunisia and the French in Karachi, the bombing of the giant French tanker in Yemen, the killing of Marines in Failaka in Kuwait, and the British and Australians in the Bali explosions, the recent operation in Moscow, and some sporadic operations here and there are only reactions and reciprocal actions. What U.S. President George Bush, the pharaoh of this age, was doing in terms of killing our sons in Iraq, and what Israel, the United States ally, was doing in terms of bombing houses that shelter old people, women, and children with U.S.-made aircraft in Palestine, were sufficient to prompt the sane among your rulers to distance themselves from this criminal gang. Our kinfolk in Palestine have been slain and severely tortured for nearly a century. If we defend our people in Palestine, the world becomes agitated and allies itself against Muslims, unjustly and falsely, under the pretense of fighting terrorism. What do your governments want by allying themselves with this criminal gang in the White House against Muslims? Do your governments not know that the White House gangsters are the biggest butchers of this age? What do your governments want from their alliance with America in attacking us in Afghanistan? I mention in particular Britain, France, Italy, Canada, Germany, and Australia. We warned Australia before not to join in Afghanistan and against its despicable effort to separate East Timor. It ignored the warning until it woke up to the sounds of explosions in Bali. Its government falsely claimed that they were not targeted. If you were distressed by the deaths of your men and the men of your allies in Tunisia, Karachi, Failaka, Bali, and Amman, remember our children who are killed in Palestine and Iraq every day. Remember our deaths in coast mosques. And remember the premeditated killing of our people in weddings in Afghanistan. If you were distressed by the killing of your nationals in Moscow, remember ours in Chechnya. Why should fear, killing, destruction, displacement, orphaning, and widowing continue to be our lot, while security, stability, and happiness be your lot? This is unfair. It is time that we get even. You will be killed just as you kill, and will be bombed just as you bomb. And expect more that will further distress you. The Islamic nation, thanks to God, has started to attack you at the hands of its beloved sons, who pledged to God to continue jihad as long as they are alive, through words and weapons to establish right and expose falsehood. In conclusion, I ask God to help us champion his religion and continue jihad for his sake until we meet him, while he is satisfied with us, and he can do so. Praise be to Almighty God.
And there was the audio tape broadcast on Al Jazeera yesterday, featuring a voice that many believe belongs to the world's most wanted terrorist, Osama bin Laden. The English translation was read by WBUR's Mitch Wortlieb. Jack Beatty, here in a recording that was heard by millions and millions and millions of Muslims around the world, and now by us learning what was said as well, is an eloquent synthesizer and reductionist. All these complaints are one, and violence is the answer to all of these complaints.
Yes, and if you think of him as a politician, he really is speaking to his core audience, and he's saying, "You have suffered." He talks about Iraq. He talks about the Palestinians. He talks about Chechnya. He mentions Afghanistan, the bombing of people. You know, the accidental massacre of the wedding party, and he sort of takes all these points of distress and weaves them, and says, you know, we have suffered, and now it's their turn. It's an argument from justice, really, that he's trying to make.
And always with Osama bin Laden history, he calls Bush, I don't know if people could hear it, but he calls him the Pharaoh, the Pharaoh of this age, the Pharaoh as the symbol that Islam was in opposition to. He describes Dick Cheney and Colin Powell as having killed and destroyed in Baghdad more than the Mongols.
Yes.
History, singing out to pull that historic memory together.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised we didn't, and he mentioned some of the old imperialist powers, Britain and France. Again, going back to that well of discontent and resentment of the West in that part of the world.
These are tough and bitter words, but millions of Muslims are hearing them. It's important for us to know what's being said out there. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorio.